Let's say that Jesus told these stories around the year 30. You know, it could have been 25 to 30, but we don't know. The calendar's all messed up, but we don't worry about that. We'll just say that Jesus told these stories about the year 30. Then he was gone, and the church was left with the stories. Now, how does the church preserve the stories? They preserve them in one way, they preserve them with more intensity than you and I preserve them. You and I do not work as hard at remembering stories as ancient Israel did. Papyrus and books were very unusual. So what they had, mostly, were oral traditions, stories from grandparents to parents to children. Consequently, remembering those stories and passing those stories on was an extremely important part of their life. The Genesis accounts are all audio before they're ever written down. For centuries, hundreds of years, they are oral tradition before they become written tradition. Okay. But what we have is from the year 30 up to at least the year 64. The first gospel is the gospel of what? Who? Wrong. Mark. Thank you. It's okay. That was an unfair question because it's... Anyway, the first gospel is the gospel of Mark. It was written about the year 64. We have from the year 30 up to the year 60, 34 approximately, year time span. What happens to the stories in 34 years? A lot of things happen. Please.
They found that Mark was written before that around 50.
So
I don't know
how. 50? I never heard that.
At least it's, I read in how listed.
Okay, well, I've never heard a date that early. The earliest I ever heard was 64, but lots of folks work on that stuff, and maybe they've come up with new stuff since I've read that. But anyway, there is a long time period there. Some things are going to happen to the stories. One of the things that's going to happen is that if the story goes from here to Wenatchee, the people in Wenatchee who are going to tell the story will add some things to the story to make it make sense for their place. If the story moves from Palestine to Rome in its telling, some of the details of the story have to be changed because the people in Rome don't understand Palestinian agriculture. I mean, they never went to Israel on a tour, you know. They don't do that. You don't take vacations, see. So if the story moves across the Mediterranean, as it did, it has to pick up the flavor and the life of the people that it's being told in. That makes sense, doesn't it? Do you understand that? If we tell a parable about trails, and somebody in Wenatchee's never been on a trail, they have to tell a story about a sidewalk. Okay. Same story, but they have to adjust it to their own situation. All right, that's one thing. Second thing is that soon after Jesus was gone, or actually immediately after Jesus was gone, the big emphasis in the church was, when is he coming back? And that is called the parousia. When is Jesus returning? St. Paul, the writings of St. Paul are the earliest recorded history of the church that we have before the Gospels. In St. Paul, we read about Paul telling people, please go back to work, you know, because they sold their businesses and they bought tents and they went out and they camped in the hillsides and they waited for Jesus to come back. Jesus didn't come back. That was a problem, see? Because where's the Lord? Well, he's supposed to be back with us any day now. Well, he didn't show up. Well, he'll be back next month. Well, he didn't show up. Next year. Next year. Next year. So consequently, the parables, some of the parables that we're going to look at today, changed their emphasis from what the way in which Jesus originally gave them. They changed their emphasis so as to explain why he wasn't coming back. We're going to look at some parables that in their original form meant one thing, but then 40 years later, the church took those same parables and they reinterpreted them so as to help explain to each other where was Jesus. I mean, that was a problem, right? I mean, if we're sitting around waiting for Jesus and that he's the center of our faith and he's not back yet, you and I have adjusted to that. We're used to it. They weren't used to it. Okay? They have. How do you adjust to it? You adjust to it by having stories, by having your scriptures explain it. Okay, so the parables oftentimes, some of the parables explain or have an emphasis of be firm in waiting for Jesus. I'm suggesting that that wasn't the original emphasis. Sometimes was not the original emphasis at all. We have a long time period. The Gospel of John, which includes very few parables, but anyway, the Gospel of Luke was not written probably until 70, 71, or 72. So you see, there's a long time period. When stories last that long, something has to happen to the stories. They get changed, they get adapted, and that's what's happening. Now the question, the last thing I want to say by way of preface here, is what do we mean by the phrase that says that the scriptures are true, that the Bible is true? It means this. To me, I suggest this, that the Bible is not a absolutely infallible report of every scientific geographic detail in ancient Israel. Rather, it is infallible in that it tells the story of God's love, and in that telling, it is without error. The parable in Matthew, the parable in Mark, the parable in Luke, how can the same story be told three different ways? Did Jesus tell the story three times? Or did each gospel writer report it differently? I suggest to you that Jesus told one parable, it got reported three different ways. Does that mean the Bible's not true? Absolutely not. The Bible is true. The details were changed through the history of the church. That does not mean the scriptures are not true. When we say that the Bible is the inerrant, infallible word of God, what we are saying is that the message contained therein, the message of God's justice and judgment and God's grace, is a message without error and totally true. We say that the Holy Spirit wrote the scriptures. I believe that. That the Holy Spirit was the writer of the Bible. The message is consistent from Genesis to Revelation. The message is consistent from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The little details are not always the same. If we are nervous about the little details being different, then we have to throw the whole story out. Because over in the Gospel of John, for example, Jesus goes to Jerusalem three times. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, he only goes once. Well, which is it, three or one? Well, they have different purposes in writing. Hence, they report different things. What's infallible is the message that is without error. Okay, that's what I suggest to you. Now, that is a big topic. The question of what is the Bible. But as we go through these parables, and when I say things like, Jesus didn't really say that, but yet it says in the Bible, and Jesus said, but yet I'm a smart aleck enough to say, well, Jesus didn't really say that. That is really pompous, to say that. Well, it is pompous to say it. On the other hand, it is saying that God gives us gifts and gives to the church the gifts of interpreting the scripture, but after all the interpretation is done, we come up with the Lord and the truth about it. Is that all clear or not? Huh?
Say it one more time.
What? Oh, well. About interpreting the scriptures, yeah. It's one of the gifts that God gives to the church is that he gives to the church the ability to interpret the scriptures. And I don't think Jesus is offended when Bible scholars conclude Jesus didn't say that. I think rather that Jesus is pleased, because when they say he didn't say that, the scholars are saying what he really said was da-da-da. And they prove it as best they can. None of the proofs are absolutely rock hard. You can't prove anything beyond a shadow of a doubt, especially literature that's 2,000 years old. But I believe what we do is we get closer to Jesus, to the original Jesus. If we read a parable like we're going to do today, the emphasis of the parable is clearly the church. That's okay. But that's a 40-year-old, and that's an interpretation from the year 70. What we're hoping to do is to get closer to Jesus. And if a scholar can help us get closer to Jesus, then we're thankful to God for that. Not all scholarship helps us get closer to Jesus. Some will take us away. You know. But that doesn't mean we can't try. That's what I'm trying to say. We're looking at parables of assurance. We've looked at mustard seed. Remember now, what you keep in mind here is Wes Prevout on the road, right? Okay, you've got the image out here of Wes is on the road, and this is a terrible idea, Holden Village. And your church at home and the whole kingdom is a bad idea. And people are nervous and upset. And to those of us who are afraid, and most of us are most of the time about the future of the kingdom, these parables of assurance. We've looked at three. We're going to look at the parable of the patient farmer. That is Mark 4:26. Mark 4:26. Mark 4:26. You're going to find in Mark the oldest reporting of the parables. Oftentimes we'll look there to try to find if we have any clues about what is original. Mark 4:26. Everybody have a copy of yeah, all right. And he said, "The kingdom of God is as if a man should scatter seed upon the ground, and should sleep and rise night and day, and the seed should sprout and grow, he knows not how." In other words, he didn't go to the University of Washington to study genetics, right? Or whatever you learn there. "The earth produces of itself, first the blade, then the ear, then the full grain in the ear. But when the grain is ripe, at once he puts in the sickle, because the harvest has come." The parable of the sower, you remember, ended with saying, "And the harvest was 100-fold, 60-fold, 30-fold." The parable of the sower ended by saying that God is the miracle grower of the kingdom. Okay? This is the same story. That God is the miracle grower of the kingdom. Why should we be assured that the kingdom is in good hands? Because God is the grower of the kingdom, and we are not. All right. Again, it's a contrast parable. Remember the contrast of the mustard seed? Little mustard seed, big tree. Little leaven, big loaf. Okay? God plants in the sower, big crop. God plants here, big results. Same thing, over and over. It's the same story told in different ways. Please notice here that the farmer goes to town and has coffee. Notice this? Sleep and rise, night and day. Seed should sprout and grow. He knows not how. Okay? Basically, the farmer goes to town to have coffee. In the morning, comes back in the night, does it every day. Doesn't really do anything. Doesn't know how it grows, but it grows. All right. Do you sense the assurance there? We are the incompetent farmer. All we know how to do is go to town and have coffee. As far as building the kingdom, we're rather inept. we picture the group of people that Jesus spoke this parable to originally. Every parable, we try to ask the question, to whom was this parable addressed? And we can guess some things. It may well have been addressed to a group of people who were saying, please, Jesus, would you get on with it? We know that in the early church, there was a large group of people that were anxious for Jesus to be the leader on a white horse of a political revolution. The zealots were looking for a Messiah to drive out the occupying armies of Rome. All right. So that was one emphasis in the early church. They said, great, now we got a Messiah. Let's kick these buggers out of here and let's get on with it so we can have our own country, right? And we'll have a really good time. So they say to Jesus, well, you're doing good so far, but come on, let's go. What are you waiting for? You know, you've got us with you now. Let's get some armies together and let's get them. To all the rest of us who are kind of hyperthyroids, you know, who want to do and want to produce and want to make the kingdom here, the parable is spoken. It's spoken to those of us who would trust our own ingenuity and creativity more than we would trust the power and the grace of God in the growth of the kingdom. A parable of assurance. Okay, you want to... Is that clear? Yeah? Yeah, that's simple enough, right? Okay. And you see that all four of those are really the same. Mustard seed, leaven, sower, and patient farmer, all four have the same thing. Now, we've got two parables that speak to the question, how can we be so confident? And Jesus comes along and says, don't worry, everything's going to be okay. But then the normal question is, well, how do you know everything's going to be okay? I mean, that's a normal question, right? Jesus then has some parables to tell us why everything's going to be okay, why we should be so confident. And they're both very closely related, and they're very similar. Unjust judge and the friend who calls at night. Unjust judge. Luke 18:2, please. Luke 18:2. Start at 1, Luke 18:1. And he told them a parable to the effect that they ought always to pray and not lose heart. So, now, verse 1 here is an editorial introduction to the parable. It makes us think that the parable is about prayer. Don't automatically assume that it's about prayer. Not losing heart? Yes, it's about not losing heart. But it really isn't about prayer at all. Well, it is in a way, indirectly, but not directly about prayer at all. Okay, number and two. He said, in a certain city there was a judge who neither feared not God nor regarded man. And there was a, in other words, the judge. Like Judge Sylvester in Crookston, right? And there was a widow in that city who kept coming to him and saying, vindicate me against my adversary. For a while he refused, but afterward he said to himself, though I neither fear God nor regard man, yet because this widow bothers me, I will vindicate her, or she will wear me out with her continual complaining. Isn't that funny? No, continual come. And the Lord said, hear what the unrighteous judge says, and will he not hear what the unrighteous judge says? And will not God vindicate his elect, who cry to him day and night? Will he delay long over them? I tell you, he will vindicate them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth? Let's look at line by line. One, the first line, as suggested to you, is an editorial introduction to the parable, but really, the parable is really not about prayer. It's about something else. Yes.
Prayer is expanded from not that time you go along, but a reflectiveness or an observation in life, a respect
then
for
it is about
God
prayer.
Would bring to
yes.
Us.
Yes. Then it is about prayer.
Yes.
Okay. Number two, the judge does not respect God or does not respect man. That is, it really doesn't care what anybody says. You know, like Judge Sirica, everybody was mad at Judge Sirica during Watergate. And he didn't, everybody was mad. Both sides were mad at him. And he had to be the kind of judge who frankly didn't care what anybody thought. He just had to do whatever he thought because he was in an impossible situation. Well, this judge, Jesus says, isn't a righteous judge. He doesn't care what God thinks, doesn't care what people think. Third, widow. It's not necessary that the widow be elderly. Marriage was common age 13 or 14. Most women were married. That was the normal marrying age. And so it was possible then to be a widow at 15. I mean, people die very suddenly, obviously. And so it's we can think of a widow not necessarily as being an elderly person, but of any age. She's got a problem, and she brings the problem to a judge, to an individual judge. She does not bring her problem to a tribunal, which means that her problem was probably over money matters like inheritance. If it was over property rights or something like that, it would come to three judges. But the story is about a particular judge, so probably it is money matters, most likely inheritance from her deceased husband. Widows traditionally in the Old Testament are the defenseless ones. They are the ones who really have no rights. She is unable to bribe the judge because she doesn't have any money. All right? And so her only way of winning this contest with the judge, this argument with the judge, is with persistence, since she's really kind of broke, and the issue is probably over money. Verse 4, please note, he would not venture. He wouldn't make up his mind. He just kind of sat on the case, delayed the bench or whatever it's called, set it aside or whatever. The answer wouldn't come. In 5, please. The judge finally gives in to her requests simply because the widow got on his nerves. This widow. Have you ever heard that phrase before? This. What other parable did you hear this? Prodigal son. The eldest brother says,
this son of yours.
Okay. When the Greek writes this widow, this son, it's kind of like, you know, and miserable. That, you know, the emphasis is there from the inclusion of that word. It's a slanderous, spiteful reference, just like in the prodigal son. The persistence of the widow is the clincher. What wins the day is the persistence of the woman. Verse 7. Well, a good translation of 7 is this. Will not God hasten to rescue his elect who cry to him day and night, even if he puts their patience to the test? That's a good translation of 7. Verse 8. Speedily means that God will help suddenly and unexpectedly. The second line in 8, please. 8b, notice. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth? It doesn't match. It's a strange ending to the story. 8b is an extremely grave and serious note that doesn't really. I mean, you're reading along the parable and everything's fine, and all of a sudden you get 8b and you don't know what to do with it. It just kind of sits in there strangely. It may not be original. No, I'm not done. The central figure in the parable is the persistent woman. But what Jesus, I think, wants us to concentrate on in the parable is the judge. Because we could say this, that if this inconsiderate judge who refused to hear the woman's case finally gives in to her, how much more will a loving judge, that is God, listen to us? Okay? It's just a comparison. If this unrighteous judge listens to the persistent woman, how much more will a loving father listen to us? So in that way it is about prayer, all right? Why should you be confident about the assurance that God gives? That's the question here. Why should we feel so confident? Because God will listen to us. If this miserable judge listened to this woman who is complaining to him day and night, so how much more will a loving father listen to you and me who bring our petitions to him? Okay. Parable of assurance about a reason why we should be confident. There's one other one. Luke 11:5.
So it's then also about the nature of God.
It is about the nature of God. It is about the nature of God, right. Yes. Yeah. And the next one is really the same thing.
What's number there?
Excuse me?
11:5.
11:5 in Luke, the parable of the friend who asked for help at night. It's going to be the same thing. If this miserable judge listens, how much more will a loving God listen? If, da-da-da, how much more? Fill in the blanks, okay? This is going to be the same thing. And he said to them, which of you has a friend who will go to him at midnight and say to him, friend, lend me 3 loaves, for a friend of mine has arrived on a journey and I have nothing to set before him. And he will answer from within, do not bother me. The door is shut now and my children are in bed with me and I cannot get up and give you anything. Does the nagging sound familiar? Right? That's just like the last parable, pleading. Okay? I tell you, though he will not get up and give him anything because he is a friend, yet because of his importunity, yet because of his continual begging, he will rise and will give him whatever he needs. And I tell you, ask and it will be given you, seek and you will find, knock and it will be open for everyone who asks, receives, etc., etc. It goes on and on. That last part is kind of an application to the parable added on later. All right, verse 5, please. What's verse 5 say? Which of you who has a friend will go to him at midnight and say to him, friend, lend me 3 loaves? They did not have 7-Elevens in Palestine, okay? They did not have Red Owls that were open 24 hours a day. So, if you arrive late at night, and they didn't have cafes either, except, I mean, places to buy meals, only in the largest cities. In small towns, they did not have that kind of thing. So, if you're arriving in a typical Palestinian village late in the evening, and you need something to eat, where do you get something to eat? Only from people, right? Only from your friends. The women were the bakers, and the baking was done before sunrise. They baked the bread for the day early in the day. Normally, they would bake like Whopper. You know, ever remember Whoppers at the Burger King? Okay, they're about this big. Remember in the old days, they're about this. The buns are about this big. All right, and each person in the family, each adult person, would have 3 a day. So about one small loaf a day. And the women in the village rose early and fired up their little ovens inside their houses or right out by the front door, and depending on the altitude they were living at, and they would bake the bread for the day. Now, one of the things that everybody in town knows is which women always bake more than they need. I bet your grandmother knew up and down the road who baked what and how much they baked, right? My grandmother baked caramel rolls and always too many, all right? It was just normal that you had to have more than you needed. It was impolite to have too little. Well, in any village, somebody's going to know that Mrs. So-and-so always bakes 4 instead of 3 per person. So she's always got something left at the end of the day. Okay, and there's no cafes in town, remember. But everybody knows who's got extra bread. All right. The guest comes a long way. Feeding the guest is not an option. You just didn't discuss that. You know, even if you didn't know the person, or if it was just a casual acquaintance, staying alive is of primary importance. We share our bread with each other in Palestine because we have to stay alive. There aren't many of us. See? So, the feeding of friends is not an option. It is a normal part of life. Everybody does it. Now, what happens? Please notice in verse 7. What's it say in 7? And he will answer from within, do not bother me, the door is shut now, my children are in bed with me, and I cannot get up and give you anything. Alright. You go to bed when the sun goes down. The reason is because it's dark. And the oil is expensive. So you work early in the morning, but then when the sun goes down, you go to bed. And it says that the door is shut and it's bolted. the bolts on doors were really beams. The doors were low, and they were very heavy, and the lock on the door was simply a series of four iron rings. Two on the walls, on the side of the wall, and then two in the door itself. And the rings were 3 to 5 inches in diameter, and they clanked. All right? So there's 1, 2, 3, 4 rings. When you go to bed at night, how do you bolt the door? You pick up the bolt log, this long, smooth, this wide, and you slip it in the rings. Clank, 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 and clank. Okay? You got this post across the door. And then when you go to bed, everybody sleeps in the same bed. And it's on a higher platform off to the side of the little house. Mama, Daddy, and all the kids are in bed together. Everybody sleeps like Eskimos. They're all together. So a knock comes at midnight because the woman of this house always bakes a little extra bread, and somebody knows that. The knock comes at midnight. Now what's going to happen? All the kids are going to wake up. Right? It's like on a camping trip when someone has to go potty or something. Right? All the kids are going to wake up, and you take, and how do you open the door? Clank, 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 clank. Right? And you set the post up. Well, now all the kids are awake. All the neighbors have heard that you're opening the door, and this person is knocking on the door. Okay? You get the picture in ancient, and everybody's listening to the story. See, Jesus is telling the story. And everybody understands it. Because nobody wants to wake their kids up in the middle of the night. And nobody wants to undo that door in the middle of the night. I mean, everybody's saying, boy, yeah, that's right, Jesus, that's no fun getting a knock at midnight. Okay, they all understand the story that he's telling. Verse 8. I tell you, though he will not get up and give him anything because he is a friend, yet because of his continual knocking at the door, his importunity, the person will rise and will give him whatever he needs. For I tell you, ask and it will be given, seek and you will find, knock and it will be opened. The point of the parable is the same as the one before. You don't want to get up, but you will because of the asking. How much more will our loving Father, who hears us and cares about us, how much more will he readily get up at night and answer our requests, our knocks on the door? Okay? Why should we be confident? Because, well, we'll get up and answer the door begrudgingly. God will get up and answer the door happily. He won't go away. That's a good way to... Okay. That's good. Yeah. The person's obnoxious. Right? Stands out in the street. Bang, 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 bang. Go away. Now, we were talking about Trident missiles in here the other day. And we were talking about the fact that the warheads in the Trident submarine are 5 times more powerful than the one dropped on Hiroshima. And that one warhead dropped in Seattle will immediately kill Seattle, Tacoma area, kill all those people instantly. Then Vancouver, B.C. will be killed within 30 minutes or so just from intense, immediate radiation fallout. And that all unprotected people who are not hiding inside buildings, tightly closed buildings, and in other words, people who are outside and all animals outside, birds and everything, all the way from Seattle to Coeur d'Alene will die, because the westerly winds will immediately start pushing this cloud over us and will start to fall down, and the animals and the birds and everything will be dead from Seattle to Coeur d'Alene from one bomb. Okay. Jesus had an image. He had a picture of disaster. And it's an image that it's strange to us. I don't understand it. But he told more stories in this next category than any other category. He told more stories about being in the sight of disaster than in any other category.
More stories, you mean
more parables. There are more parables in this category than in any other. There is danger, and it's right now, and it's right on us. We are in the sight of disaster. Can't you see it? Right. Now, what is the catastrophe Jesus sees? It's for, you know, I don't frankly know. Maybe he had an image of, maybe he saw something political happening. Maybe the disaster picture he saw was simply in terms of the church, of what Judaism had become, scribes and Pharisees and all that, whatever. The kind of urgency that you and I could feel about a trident, about a bomb falling on Seattle, and knowing what that would do to every living creature from here to Coeur d'Alene, you know, the kind of, you don't even know what to do. I mean, somebody the other day said, Gemma said, I get so mad, I can't talk. You know, I mean, you think of that, of 400 bombs like that in one submarine. That's how powerful each ship is going to be. 400 bombs that have that capability in one boat. And Gemma says, I get so mad I don't even know what to say. You know, okay, that kind of disaster that once in a while we'll let ourselves even think about, because it's so horrible even to imagine it. We don't even want to think. I turn on the radio and listen to music because I don't want to think about it. You know? It's so terrible. Well, Jesus had this understanding of disaster. All of these parables are not about assurance. These parables are a call to repentance. They are echoes from John the Baptist. They have, the first one we look at has an allusion, a rather obvious allusion to John the Baptist, as a matter of fact. They are warnings. They are Jesus trying to help blind people see what's actually going on. Okay. The first one, children in the marketplace, Matthew 11. 11, 16. Have you shifted now? Do you understand the shift? We were talking about assurance, now we're talking about judgment. Okay? There's a shift. 11, 16. But to what shall I compare this generation? It is like children sitting in the marketplaces and calling to their playmates. We piped to you and you would not dance. We wailed and you would not mourn. For John came, neither eating nor drinking, and they say, he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, behold, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Yet wisdom is justified by her deeds. Tough, isn't it? This is the hard one. This is...
What's the last one?
Yeah, isn't that something?
God's wisdom, however, is shown to be true by its results.
God's wisdom is shown to be true by its results. All right. The last line. This is a... Please, Liz Lincoln, describe what's going on here with the children. What are they doing? Tell us what are the kids doing here?
I think they're just kind of playing.
What are they doing to each other? Taunting. How do they taunt each other? What do they say? It's a street scene. Some children are saying, we blew our recorders, but you wouldn't dance. Spoil sports. You're no fun. Other kids are saying, we wailed, and you would not mourn. The piping, the playing the recorder and the dancing, that was a festival that the men did, okay? You do your Finnish dances, the men did the dancing, right? The women, Orthodox Jewish women, they watch while the men dance. The wailing, the funeral wailing, that the women do that. Okay, the men then stand on the sideline, and the women gather in the center and cry. Okay, that's the way they're going on. But you are right in saying that those of us, there's some of us in the middle here who are playing our flutes, and we want everybody to dance, but these people won't dance. Come on. You know, you play your finished music and everybody stands around the gymnasium and nobody will dance with you. You say, come on, what is wrong with you anyhow? Who is who here? Who is Jesus? Is he the piper?
Yeah.
He won't dance or won't? Is he the piper or is he the dancer that won't dance?
Well, he could be
Yeah. Which is it? He's the piper, you think?
He could be the piper saying, look, here's the kingdom of God, and you guys aren't coming. Or they could be saying, hey, none of this is important. It's just material things that are important. And he's not dancing because he's saying, hey, wait a minute. You know, so he's bald.
According to the story, the generation is the people who are not dancing anymore.
Excuse me, point it out.
Well, he says, he's comparing the generation to children in the marketplace. I mean, so that
is that our, that's they're both, they're doing both. The generation is both like those who are piping and those who won't dance. The generation is like those who are wailing and like those who won't mourn. The whole picture, he looks at the whole picture in front of him and he says, you know, you're calling to each other, you're calling to me, you're calling to John. The whole thing is a big game. You know, and somebody wants to call the tune, and somebody else is supposed to follow along behind. And he just, I take that the final, you know, paragraph there to be extremely ironic. I mean, nobody can please, nothing could possibly
please them.
Yeah, because it's all a push and pull kind of a game. And then the thing is about wisdom there at the end, he just, you know, he says, there's another criteria here. There's something else going on that these people don't even understand.
I think
at all.
It's people misreading the signals. You know, the generation is misreading what's happening. The Son of Man comes eating and drinking, and the generation looks at it and says, behold, we're going to be a drunkard.
Yes.
And seeing a kind of extreme, that isn't what is there at all.
So, the people then say, Jesus, you're just a drunk. But Jesus is saying, look, I'm playing a new song on my recorder, and you won't even dance to it. You won't dance to my tune. You won't cry to John the Baptist tune. Nothing's going to make you happy.
It's the inappropriateness of
how the generation responds. They won't respond to John in his call to crying, the wailing, repentance. They won't respond to Jesus in his new song playing, his new flute playing. They don't like anything.
And they see John coming being an aesthetic.
Yes.
And then they think he's crazy.
Right. Do you agree with that, Keith?
Not exactly, no. I think this is about how the generation wishes to either to call the tune or to have the choice not to play. One way or the other, people either wish to be the ones calling the tune, or at least they want the freedom to say, no, I'm not going to play that. And what they're saying about John and Jesus makes it clear that they feel like they've got the right to opt out of this game. I agree about that part of it.
Yeah.
That they're looking on these people and saying, no, we're not going to, you know, we reject you. And then I think the thing about wisdom at the end is that they haven't understood that John and Jesus aren't coming to try to organize everybody into some new game.
Do not be dismayed that we have differences of opinion on this parable. One of the introductory things I said was Jesus' parables are the best place to get to know Jesus because of their simplicity and clarity. Not true here.
You know, Paul Keller has made a film.
There is a word in 11:16. Children sitting. Kathamenenois. Okay. They build their whole case on a very technical Greek thing. Whether it's kathamenenois or kathamenenois. Or some of it's so obscure, it's like one, it's an iota, it's one letter that makes them say, it's gotta go this way. Okay. So they have concluded this, that who's playing the tune? The Jews, not Jesus. Jews are playing the tune. But Jesus and John will not dance to their tune. Okay? They won't dance to that tune anymore. And so the rest of the generation is saying to Jesus and to John, you're spoiled sports. I wouldn't suggest to you that you take that, but just listen to it. That may be what it means. But I like the other part. better. I like the other one better. C.H. Dowd and Jeremiah say that's that it's the Jews that are calling for the crying and for the piping, and Jesus and John the Baptist won't play the game anymore. When you see a cloud rising in the west, you say at once, a shower is coming, and so it happens. And when you see the south wind blowing, you say, there will be scorching heat, the Scirocco. Okay, that's the south wind out of the desert. And it happens, you hypocrites. You know how to interpret the appearance of the earth and the sky, but why do you not know how to interpret the present time? There's disaster on the way. You can read the clouds, but you can't see what's right in front of your face. Okay? That's one. We got nine more just like it. We can't do all nine, huh? Luke 17:28. 17:28. Likewise, as it was in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. But on the day when Lot went out from Sodom, fire and sulfur rained from heaven and destroyed them all. So will it be on the day that the Son of Man is revealed. On that day, let him who is in the housetop with his goods in the house not come down to take them away. And likewise, let him who is in the field not turn back. Remember Lot's wife. Whoever seeks to gain his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life will preserve it. Okay. That little thing about Sodom and Gomorrah is to say that while you and I go on feasting and dancing, a catastrophe is coming to us as it came to Sodom and Gomorrah. Disaster is on its way. Luke 17:26, just above there. They ate and they drank, they married, they were given in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all. What's coming? A new flood, a new deluge, okay? Like fire rained on Sodom and Gomorrah, there's a new fire coming, a new destruction. Rain fell at Noah's time when everybody was having a party and they didn't know what was going on, so too we're all having a party and all hell's about to break loose. The same thing's going to happen. Disaster is coming. Luke 12:49. Luke 12:49. Here's a metaphor of fire and baptism. Fire of Sodom and Gomorrah and the water of Noah's time. Both metaphors are mixed together. I came to cast fire on the earth, and would that it were already kindled. I have a baptism. 49 was about water. 50 is about fire. I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how I am constrained until it is accomplished. Do you think that I have come to give peace on earth? No, I tell you, rather, to bring division. Okay. Disaster is coming. Fire and water. Luke 13:7, right across the way. 13:7. And he said to the vine dresser, lo, these 3 years I have come seeking fruit on this fig tree, and I find none. Cut it down. Why should it use up the ground? Okay? Cut it down. It's no good. Luke 23:31. 23:31. This is about daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep. Weep for yourselves and for your children. 29. For behold, the days are coming when they will say, blessed are the barren, the wombs that never bore, the breasts that never gave suck. Then they will begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. For if they do this when the wood is green, what will happen when it is dry? The fate of the dry tree is worse than the fate of the green tree. The dry tree in a forest fire pops, just explodes. It burns quickly. It's gone. Green tree, even that burns. But a dry tree, what's the dry tree? Okay, Jesus is using analogy now. Okay, metaphor. The dry tree is the religious structure of ancient Judaism. It's going to pop in a fire. Just going to explode. Burn right up. Luke 21:34. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with dissipation and drunkenness and cares of this life, and that day come upon you suddenly, like a snare. That day, the day of disaster and catastrophe, a snare is to catch birds with. Okay, it's going to be that, catch an unwary bird. Matthew 24:28 is just really interesting. It's about vultures. 24:28. Matthew 24:28. Wherever the body is, the dead body, there the eagles, actually vultures, there the vultures will gather together. Oh, isn't that something?
That was just back in Luke.
Yeah, it's in others. The vultures gather together, okay? The vultures don't gather over nothing, do they? The vultures gather over a dead carcass. What's the dead? Do you sense this? I mean, it just goes on and on and on. More parables about this disaster than anything else. Well, there's more, but let's look at one more in Matthew 7:19. Just a second, Keith. So Matthew 7:19. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. No, they're not. Yeah. Okay, these are one-liners.
So this shows that he's saying stuff like that. But are there parables too?
Yes, yeah. These are similes, analogies, quick one-liners like new wine and old wineskins. They all have the same thing. Disaster, cut down, burn, flood, fire. And he told them a parable saying, the land of a rich man brought forth plentifully. And he thought to himself, what shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops. And he said, I will do this. I will put down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul? Isn't that funny? Say to my soul, soul? I like that. You have ample goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. Sound familiar? But God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is he who lays up treasures for himself and is not rich toward God. Let's look at individual lines and say some general things. The occasion of the parable is that up in 13, please notice, the occasion of the parable is a dispute between brothers. The younger brother is complaining that he does not get the inheritance from his older brother, okay? One of the multitude said, teacher, bid my brother divide the inheritance with me. But he said to the man, who made me a judge or divider over you? In 14, Jesus is saying, don't ask me. You know, I'm not a judge. If you want legal opinions, you have to go to somebody else. So he won't answer. And then he goes on to 15, and he said to them, take heed and beware of all covetousness, for a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. 15 probably is not original. It's an insertion. Okay, 15 doesn't fit with the rest. The parable is introduced in 14. Skip to 16, it makes sense. 15 is kind of stuck in there. It's in a way. Let's just go ahead for a second, but in 16, the barns. There's two kinds of barns that could be described in the Greek language. One kind of barn is like when you just get the corn out of the field and you put it in a who?
In a granary.
Corn crib.
A crib. A crib is where you put the whole ear of corn, correct? A granary is where the shelled corn goes, right? Okay, this particular reference here is not to the crib, but it's to the finished product. All the shelling has been done. They've got the finished product, the corn, and that's the kind of barn they're talking about here. In other words, the final product barn. This parable has been understood to be a Boy Scout, Girl Scout maxim. Okay? This is an example of a parable that teaches us this lesson. The lesson is, death comes suddenly, so don't count on money. Okay? That's not what the parable is about. It is not a maxim. It's not a cute little truth to make us feel to make us wiser. It's bigger than that. Okay. The parable, rather, is a warning about the coming judgment, the impending judgment, the catastrophe that's coming. The point of it is that we are just as foolish as this farmer who is under the threat of death if we heap up possessions while the disaster is about to happen. Okay? We are as foolish as this farmer who heaps up possessions knowing he's about to die. No. It's saying that there is a disaster coming. It's not a little instruction about how to live day to day, but rather it says that a farmer who lays up crops in a granary while the end of the world is coming, well, okay, it is a plug for the simple life. But it's bigger than that. It's saying that there is a disaster coming, and this farmer is dumb for doing this. So too, we are foolish if we think that, then it is about the simple life. So too, we are foolish laying up all these treasures when the catastrophe is about to happen. This is the parable of the servant entrusted with authority. Do you have your finger on that spot, 24:45?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, leaving a marker there, flip to Luke 12:41. Luke 12:41. It's the same parable reported twice. We're going to compare the two. Luke 12:41. First, we start with Matthew 24:45. Who then is the faithful and the wise servant whom his master has set over his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Boy, is that a dandy, huh? Good heaven. They should have gone to David Wee's writing class. Let's try that again. Would you read for us, please, from your version?
Yeah, from the beginning.
Yeah, start at the beginning through 45 and 46.
Who then is a faithful and wise servant? He is the one that his master has placed in charge of the other servants to give them their food at the proper time. How happy that servant is if his master finds him doing this when he comes home.
Thank you. Continuing now, 47. Truly I say to you, he will set him over all his possessions. But if that wicked servant says to himself, my master is delayed, and begins to beat his fellow servants and eats and drinks with the drunken, the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, at an hour he does not know, and will punish him and put him with the hypocrites. Their men will weep and they will gnash their teeth. There is one, in Matthew's account, there is one servant who has been unfaithful. This, I suggest, is a warning parable about the impending disaster. What we're going to see now is that Luke, using the same parable, has it not about one servant, but about two servants. At the beginning of the hour, I said that one of the things that happened in the early church was when Jesus didn't come back, they had to explain it. Where is Jesus, right? It's been 35, 40 years and he's not back yet. How do we answer that question? We answer the question by having some of the parables of Jesus apply to the fact that he's not back yet. What we have in Matthew is probably the original parable, a parable about the servant, that is, the Jewish religious establishment, who has been unfaithful. The master's coming back and it's going to be decision time, judgment time. Luke, rather, reports the parable to be about people who, about two servants. Now notice the story here. Luke 12:41. Peter said, Lord, are you telling this parable for all of us? And the Lord said, who then is the faithful and the wise steward to whom his master will set over his household to give them their portion of food at the proper time? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find him so doing. Truly I say to you, he will set him over all his possessions. But if that servant says to himself, my master is delayed in coming and eats, and begins to beat the messengers and the maidservants, and eat and drink and get drunk, the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and an hour he does not know, and will punish him and put him with the unfaithful. And that servant who knew his master's will but did not make ready or act according to his will shall receive a severe beating. But he who did not know and did what deserved a beating shall receive a light beating. Everyone to whom much is given, of him much will be required, and of him to whom men commit much, they will demand the more. Luke has two servants, okay? There is an addition. Luke's parable is longer, and it involves two different servants, not just one.
But the guy in charge is the one accountable.
Okay, accountable, be accountable. The emphasis on this parable, as Luke reports it, is an emphasis directed toward the early church saying, stay in there, don't give up, Jesus is coming back, be faithful, keep the faith in the church. That's the point of this parable as it's reported in this case. But the way it's reported in Matthew is that the judge is coming back and that there will be a judgment. No emphasis about faithfulness of the early disciples. So the Luke account is an altered account from the Matthew account. Altered so as to give a message to the early church that was waiting for the coming of Jesus, as opposed to the original account, which was simply saying there is a catastrophe on the way. There's two more parables, and they're both long and very detailed, and we do not have the time at all to look at them. Well, there's more than this. There's many, many more parables that fit into this category. The parable of the talents, five talents. How many talents were there? Five talents and 10 talents and five and one.
Yeah, one of them he gives 10 and then one.
Yes.
One of them he gives more to one and then less than the next.
Right. This parable is reported in Matthew, Mark, and in Luke. All three, the details of the parable are different. In one he gives five, another one he gives 10. It's not a consistent story all through them. And each of the reports of the parable of the talents in all three gospels have a different emphasis. And what we need is a piece of butcher paper, 10 feet by 10 feet, and we detail each one and see where each one goes. Well, we don't have time to do that. But each one ends up in a different spot. Just a study on the parable of the talents in Matthew, Mark, and Luke would be an interesting thing for you to do, because each one has a different point. Let me, without reading through it, let me just suggest to you what some parable scholars suggest about the parable of the talents, and that is that it is directed to the scribes and the Pharisees, to whom God has entrusted much. They buried the treasure given to them. They buried it in the ground, and when the judge comes back, they will be held accountable for it. Disaster is coming. Another parable that's in the same category is the parable of the doorkeeper, which is in Mark 13:13. Also, this parable, like the parable of the servant entrusted with authority in Matthew and Luke, is a parable affected by a parousia of consciousness in the early church. That is, a consciousness of Jesus has not come back yet, and so we have to try to explain that. This whole category, instead of disaster, not little maxims for daily living, but warning that the rain is coming, the flood's coming, the fire's coming, the judgment is coming. But the Good News Bible, for example, lists all those cross references. Yeah, so if it's reported elsewhere, if you open up to Luke, it'll say also see Mark and Matthew, it'll give you the cross references. That's another good thing about that.